Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump in late February overturned the Obama administration's transgender bathroom directive for public school students, permitting them to decide which bathroom suits their gender identity. Critics of the Obama policy argued that students should use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity at birth. Scientists still haven't conclusively nailed the underlying biological forces that drive gender identity. But they have concluded that the answer is more nuanced than the simple male-female binary of gender. Ricky Lewis has written several books about genetics and writes the DNA Science blog for the Public Library of Science. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Ricky Lewis.
Hi, thanks for asking me to join.
What's the scientific definition of gender?
Gender is what you feel you are, and it's not really scientific. It's more a feeling. And sex and gender are distinct things. So in a way, the discussion is sort of apples and oranges. And I can explain what gender identity isn't, but I can't explain what it is because we simply don't know.
What then do I ask the question, what's the scientific definition of sex?
There are a number of scientific definitions of sex, and none of them really define gender. That's the whole point. There's mm-hmm. the chromosomal sex, which is determined at conception, at fertilization, where an XX is a female and an XY is a male. Then at the six-week embryo period, a certain gene, SRY, turns on, and it makes the embryo develop as a male. But we begin existence with two sets of gonads, two sets of plumbing, more or less, and then it sort of is sculpted during the embryonic and fetal periods to make us look like a male or a female at birth. And then with a 30-second look at a baby's crotch, a doctor or a midwife will decide what the sex is, but that's not the gender. The gender is what the person feels they are. So they're different.
In your human genetics textbook, which has been updated something like 12 times now,
yeah.
which says a lot about the field in and of itself. You've amended how you cover sex and gender over the years. What's changed?
Well, in my first edition, I didn't mention gender or gender identity at all. And then starting with the second edition, I included what I've just said, and I added genetic identity after all the other ways of determining sex. But then I did a lot of reading. I wrote some articles on what was erroneously called sexual reassignment surgery. I read the book about there were several cases of, there's a famous case of a boy baby who had his penis cut off because the circumcision was botched, and he was raised as a girl, and he was convinced that he was a boy. He knew he was a boy, and I know that's not the same thing as transgender, but it just shows that people know what they are. So with the later editions of my book, I started including a paragraph defining transgender, and when my book was reviewed prior to publication, professors asked me to take it out because they said, well, there's no genetic evidence that transgender is genetic, so take it out. And I refused because even if we don't know that there are no genetic determinants of transgender, people want to know what the definition is because there's so much misunderstanding. So there really isn't that much known that I could find about the genetics of transgender, but I don't really think it's that relevant. I don't think you can ever have a test for transgender other than asking a person what they are.
Yeah, because at the end of the article that I read that you recently wrote, you pondered the question of what if they can identify a transgender gene eventually, what difference does it make?
Yeah, I think it would do more harm than good. I mean, imagine being told that when your baby's born.
What do you do?
You know, what do you do? What do you do? So,
we are talking about the science of transgender today. It's brought up a lot in political discussions about whether a child should decide for him or herself or their self, whether they use the male bathroom, the female bathroom, or maybe the staff bathroom in a public school. If you have a question or comment, my guest right now is Ricky Lewis. She's a geneticist and a science writer. give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, later on in the program, we're going to have a physician from Ohio State University who treats and works with transgender patients. And we're also going to hear about the whole method of treating and what transgender people who identify as transgender, some of their specific issues that they deal with and grapple with in finding physicians and getting treated for their issues. And you said that instructors ask, well, what do we know about anything about whether transgenderism runs in families?
I've not been able to find anything. I actually looked for that. So I don't even know if this has been studied. And I do read the genetics literature all the time, and I've not seen that. But one thing I wanted to add is that sometimes there can be mismatches in which the external genitalia or even the internal stuff doesn't match the chromosome. So you can look like a female on the outside but actually be XY. That would be an androgen insensitivity syndrome, or you can have it going the other way. Because last week's blog post, I was actually coming up with a scenario where we would check chromosomes in bathrooms to make it even more authoritative than it is now, and realize that having a simple way to check sex chromosomes, that wouldn't even tell you what someone's gender is.
You wrote about a woman who, as a child, had she had testicles, but they were non-descended. I don't know how you put it. And so she had kind of parts of two sets of plumbing, and her parents actually lied to her about why she was having surgery when she was 12 or 13 years old.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Okay, then it wasn't you. But yeah, it had to do with the two sets of plumbing. One was not, the testicles were non-descended, and they never talked to her about it. And afterwards, she wondered, what's so bad about telling me that?
Oh, that's right. I did write that.
Okay.
I never remember what I've written.
I think I'm going crazy every
day. Right. That's the Brenda David case. Yeah. That's not quite the same thing. That's the one with the botched circumcision.
Right. That's not the botched. That was a botched circumcision?
It was. It was in a book written by John Colapinto. It was an article in Rolling Stone magazine. And the case is very famous. The young man's name was David Reamer. He eventually killed himself, unfortunately. So his penis was damaged during the circumcision. And because the surgeon messed up, and they pressured the parents into actually removing the penis and telling this little boy that he was a girl. And he was told at age 14 that the reason he acted like a boy was because he was a boy. This is how confusing it can get. And that's not the same as transgender, but it just shows you how strong those feelings are of whether we're male or female.
Do you want to know as a geneticist if there is a link?
Yeah, I'm just curious. It's such a strong feeling. It's just not like somebody weighing evidence and deciding what they are. I mean, little children know when they're transgender. They know it. So I don't know what the genetics could possibly be. I'm thinking maybe it's more an endocrine thing, some kind of event during a pregnancy that affects the hormones, and your physician guest should be able to talk about that. I would think more it's something environmental during the pregnancy, because it does manifest so early in life, than something that's inherited. Because I can't imagine how a single gene could do this, could make someone so sure of what they are.
Is it likewise very unclear, then? We still say that it's very unclear. We don't know if there's a genetic link with being gay, with sexual preference in relationships.
Well, that's a whole different question,
right.
And sexual orientation has nothing to do with gender identity. And in the 1990s, there was a study that found supposedly genes on the X chromosome that were shared, the gene variants were shared more often amongst gay brothers than amongst brothers who weren't gay. That was Dean Hamer's work, and that I wrote a whole bunch of articles back then. That was considered preliminary genetic evidence of being able to inherit homosexuality, but the work was not discredited, but never confirmed, and it kind of faded away. But the sexual orientation is completely separate from the gender identity issue, as far as I know.
There isn't a lot of research out there on this, right?
Right.
Why? I mean, from what you understand about how how it works when it comes to research on issues, why not?
Well, if you look at, genetics journals and medical journals, I think there's more emphasis on diseases, and I would never consider transgender a disease at all. I think it's a variant of normal. Mm-hmm. So you don't see very many articles on common things and normal things. Most genetic research is on, more rarer conditions, and the reason for that is that, of course, it's interesting in and of itself, and we want to help people with rare diseases, but learning about the rare diseases will tell us about the more common diseases. So I don't know. I'm just speaking just for myself, but maybe transgender is not considered pathology. So why would it be looked at that much? It's like a variation of normal.
This might do for the next guest, but let's see. If Holly from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. You may have answered my question a little bit by your sexual preference question, but I was wondering if there was any research done, especially with adolescents, regarding sexual preference being a guide or some sort of determinant when people are developing their gender identity.
I can't really answer that. It's not really my field, but I don't think so. Everything I've read, one has nothing to do with the other, because a transgender person can be gay or straight or lesbian or bisexual. So, yeah, one doesn't predispose to the other, as far as I know.
Thanks to Holly for that question, though. We'll see if we can't get that answered later on in the program.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think. The genes don't lie, right? We know this is something you can look at and see.
Well, that's not entirely true. That idea is very popular. It's called genetic determinism, that your genes determine who you are, and they really don't. You take 100 people with the mutations for sickle cell disease, they won't all have sickle cell disease. Some won't, because genes affect each other. So you can't look at a genotype for one gene and say this will absolutely happen. So there really aren't any absolutes in genetics. So it's not really written in stone that much. I just fear that if there's ever a genetic test for transgender, that it would be used as a tool of discrimination.
Or elimination.
Or elimination. I'm not sure it would help people. I think the way to help people is probably your next guest talking about the treatments. I don't mean to imply that it's a pathology, but the things that transgender people can do to make their outsides more consistent with what they know they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's the way to go about it. Genetically, we call it the genotype versus the phenotype. The genotype are the genes, and I think that's what you're asking about. The phenotype are the outward appearances and symptoms if you're talking about a disease. So sometimes the genotype doesn't translate into the phenotype. This is why a test at birth or prenatally would be really dangerous, because sometimes it's not accurate. Like, we're finding more and more people have genotypes that indicate they should have a disease, but they don't. Well, why don't they? If we study why they don't, we'll find the genes that will explain why they're protected. So genetics is not destiny. In other words, it's information and it can guide things, but it's not the bottom line final answer on what a person has or is.
Ricky Lewis, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for calling.
Ricky Lewis is a science writer and DNA science blog with the Public Library, writes the DNA science blog for the Public Library of Science. More on this topic coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When President Trump in late February rescinded the Obama-era directive giving transgender students the choice of bathrooms in public schools, the issue reemerged as a controversy both in the courts, schools, and public discourse. We just heard about the science of sex, how it is no longer considered a binary male or female question, but it's more nuanced and complicated. Physicians who treat people who identify as transgender know this well. Joining us by phone is the director of the Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery at the Boston University Medical Center and a member of the Endocrine Society Task Force on Transgender Clinical Practice Guidelines, Dr. Joshua Safer. Boy, is that a mouthful.
Happy to be here.
Why does the, is it endocrine?
I guess we say endocrine.
Endocrine Society need a task force on transgender clinical practice guidelines.
Well, the Endocrine Society is the largest organization in the world of medical people and scientists who are involved in endocrinology. And basically, we have guidelines for care of all sorts of individuals in all sorts of circumstances that require hormones. And this is one of them.
And so what are the guidelines like? What are you? What are the issues that you address in those guidelines?
The first thing we do is we talk about diagnosis, and then we go into what the data are. We try to be evidence-based. We are a scientific organization. So there are not many data, but there are some. And so we try to use those data to try to gauge what regimens are going to work best in terms of treating people so their appearance is how they want it to be, and also in terms of what is safe and what needs to be followed over time for medical people.
What do you mean by diagnosis? If someone says, I'm a boy or a girl or a man or a woman, what are you diagnosing then?
In 2017, we're diagnosing them as transgender or gender incongruent. Actually, in terms of the computer systems that are out there right now, these terms are not even there yet, but that's kind of the phrasing that we're using, meaning that gender identity, which we believe has a significant biological component, does not align with the body parts that you're seeing.
Although it remains unclear what causes this, you have said that the scientific evidence is clear that gender identity is a biological phenomenon. That's a big issue because physicians don't want to treat someone for something that might be a mental or psychological issue. What do we mean by biological phenomenon?
So what we mean by a biological phenomenon is that somewhere in there, and I can't tell you the specific of what it is, but somewhere in the brain there is something that is coded by your genes or influenced by your genes, which lets you know your gender identity. And that's very important because it means that that's not something that we can externally shift. You know, by contrast, when we say that something is a mental or a behavioral health condition, then what we're saying is that you're feeling, well, the term we're now using is gender dysphoria for somebody who is having difficulty with that incongruence between their identity and their body parts. And if it's a mental health condition, what we're saying is the problem is that you feel bad about it, and therefore the treatment is going to be to make you not feel bad about it, but not really to buy into your concern, because your concern is not legitimate. That's part of your problem that you think it is. By contrast, when we say it's biological, what we're saying is what you think is exactly right. That is what your body, that's your body. There's nothing we're going to do to change that, and therefore we're not going to counsel you to go along with it. Rather, we're going to try to help you in some other fashion.
Just talking about this, someone said to me earlier today, why should a doctor be able to diagnose? Why can't you just take what a person says on face value and go with it?
I think this is how we in society organize our healthcare system in general. I think because medical treatments have consequences and have side effects, we don't have people walk to their local grocery store and simply pick up what they think they need, but rather we license medical professionals, specifically physicians, but including others, of course, to make some of those judgment calls and to counsel people in terms of how they should do things correctly. And, of course, there's a range, right, because I said the grocery store. And so if you have a headache, you don't need a doctor to make sure you're dealing with it safely most of the time. You go pick up your Tylenol. So we have a range, but for more involved things, we say, no, you cannot just walk into the pharmacy and self-treat because you might be getting it wrong or you might be taking the your medical intervention incorrectly, and so you need to go see a doctor for that.
We are talking about the issue of transgenderism. My guest is Dr. Joshua Safer. He's director of the Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery at the Boston University Medical Center. He's also a member of the Endocrine Society Task Force on Transgender Clinical Practice Guidelines. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener that gets into a little bit about what you deal with. They write, I'm a progressive, and I'm unconcerned with how people identify, dress, what bathroom they use, etc. But my concern starts when someone who is otherwise physically healthy feels the need to undergo major surgery to become quote-unquote normal. This strikes me as mental illness, not a matter of social liberation.
I think the listener really gets right to the most important point in terms of some of the stuff that I review, and that is that concern. And I think that we in the medical community had the same hypothesis as the listener, that it sounds like a mental disorder and should be treated in that fashion. And the problem is when we look at the data, we see that that sort of treatment has been a failure. So independent of looking at this as a civil rights issue or being appropriate, respectful to people looking at this, just really narrowly as a scientist, that approach does not work. And by contrast, when we recognize, based on yet other data, that gender identity has a significant biological component and that we cannot simply counsel people, and then we go what might seem to many people, including in the medical community for many years, go to the illogical step of helping people with medication and or surgery, if that's what they want, change their external appearance to meet gender identity, that has proved fabulously successful. And those are the data, 2017.
What are the medical issues most often associated with people who are transgender? Is there a set?
The medical issues?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there isn't much association. Frankly, we see transgender people across the entire range of people who are, including people totally healthy, mm-hmm. People with other conditions, all sorts of circumstances. The one exception so far that's observed is autism, where kids who are autistic or the reverse, it goes both ways. Individuals who are transgender have a greater likelihood of having both of those than, I'm kind of saying it in a muddled way here. The kids with autism have a higher chance of being transgender than kids who do not have autism.
It's interesting because I was reading about how millennials in particular, 1,000 queried on this topic, said that they thought that the issue of sexual identity, gender identity, that whole thing is along a continuum, along a spectrum, much like autism is identified now.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't want to suggest that those spectrums, quote unquote, go together.
Mm-hmm, right.
And if I'm talking as somebody who's taking a pretty strong position about the biological nature of gender identity, a question that comes to me is, well, then how do you explain a spectrum?
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah,
that you know, so I don't know if that's on your list, but the reality is that biology, first of all, is complicated. So even if it came down to one gene, let's say sometime in the future, we find out that there's one simple gene that confers your gender identity, it would still be the case that you have other biology onto which that is superimposed, and so you wouldn't necessarily see the same expression in every person. And you might see a range of how that manifests. And just that alone on a biological basis could account for a spectrum easily enough.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, people have different experiences. So even if it's biology, how people express themselves, what other things are going on in their lives. I have people who are transitioning as adults where they have relationships and kids and people who've experienced them as having one appearance. All of these things are also going to play a role in terms of what people are actually going to do about the incongruence or their being transgender.
Let's turn to a couple questions right now. Julia in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Joshua Safer. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the conversation you're having today and the focus on science and biology. And just wanted to make a plug for having a little bit of dialogue around the social implications for people who are living transgender of, I guess, this focus on solving the scientific question, mostly simply because what the reality is for people who are transgender or gender nonconforming is they're living in a climate, particularly in the United States, that's so hostile. And maybe if the doctor can just speak a little bit to the importance of that dynamic, you know, of considering, you know, how do you balance the quest for the scientific answer with the experience of the individuals and, you know, this what happens when science gets involved and we have that line between pathology and, you know, just people trying to live their lives.
Well, that's exactly a main reason why we have Dr. Joshua Safer on the show. So let's get to it. You, what historically has been difficult for transgender patients to find doctors who will treat them?
Julia, you ask a good question. Mm-hmm. And Anne, you ask a variation on a good question. So to the barrier, so the second question first. The barrier for those in the medical community is thinking about this as something where they might legitimately participate. And so the quest for thinking about this in a scientific way is helpful to those in the medical community because that's how your medical professionals are wanting to behave. And that this is... apparently has such a biological component makes it clearer to those in the medical community how they're going to approach transgender individuals and not pathologize. What we really mean when we're saying that is we are saying treating it like a mental illness, mm-hmm. as opposed to a condition where somebody simply comes and gets a medical treatment to change their appearance if that's what it seems that they need. To the comment about simply letting people live their lives, I think that is true also. And I think the thinking about this from a scientific perspective and from a medical perspective, if anything, helps us in our society. I think that in our society, we pay science, we give much respect to science and to medical care. And if I already can say with some confidence that here are the data, this is why we believe that it's a biological phenomenon, I think people are more comfortable with it and more comfortable allowing transgender individuals to simply be recognizing that it's simply a biological phenomenon. If I can give, there are a couple of examples that come to my mind quickly. You know, I think about like left-handedness, less politically fraught, I guess. We don't seem to have a controversy about which bathroom left-handed people use. But there was certainly an era when we were trying to compel everybody to be right-handed, and recognizing that it's just simply biology has ended that and allows left-handed people to be, as it were. And so I think of this maybe a little bit more of a topic that a slightly more complicated topic, but it has it's a little bit analogous to that. I'll say one more thing, which is people worry if there's a young child who says he or she is transgender, and then we know that at least some of those kids are not going to be transgender after all. The kid just is wrong, just doesn't know how to express him or herself, or is exploring and is going to come to a different decision at some point. And people are nervous that if they allow that kid to explore it, they will somehow they'll somehow abet or actually encourage the kid to act transgender when he or she would not have. And again, back to the biology and the science, if this is biological, then you need not worry too much about that actually happening, because you're not going to change the biology. We can't change the biology. And letting some kid explore is not going to change their biology.
Julia, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Email from Kelly writes, as a transgender female myself, I often wonder if the term dysphoria can be eliminated in that it automatically implies that something is wrong or not right with the person.
Yeah, I completely agree with the listener that the term dysphoria does not apply to most transgender individuals. Dysphoria suggests that there's something interfering with your daily living and making you unhappy. And I certainly have many transgender individuals who are looking for hormone treatment, which is common for many transgender individuals. And so they come to me and they say, I'm not dysphoric. I'm totally happy. I don't want to see a mental health provider to help me deal with things. I'm very well adjusted. I have many friends. Please prescribe me my hormones. And so I totally agree with the listener there.
Why has it historically been difficult for transgender patients to find doctors who will treat them with hormones, who will embark on that?
The history of medical care for transgender individuals has been exactly what we've already touched on a little bit, which is initially thinking that this is a mental illness. And if it's a mental illness, okay, if somebody says I have gender incongruence, then I'm going to send them to a mental health provider to have them deal with it and stop thinking that.
You did a pilot program at Boston University to show medical residents the science behind gender identity and what is known about it and the basics of hormone treatment. How did that go? What did you learn from them about educating them on that?
We've piloted a few programs, actually, for medical students and for residents, that is, medical trainees at advanced levels of their careers. And the big thing that we've done is teach them the science as we understand it, speaking in the language of scientists and physicians. Mm-hmm. And that's been very successful. It makes it much more accessible to to the medical students and to these physician trainees. And then they, like, quote unquote, they say things like, oh, now I get it. And then it just becomes a logic problem in terms of how best to treat people with this medical situation.
As I was reading about all of this today, I started getting the idea that gender identity is such a confluence of so many things, some more than others in any given situation. And I dread the use of the word snowflake, but is that part of what you teach, is that this is not a categorical thing where everybody's going to be the same one way or the other?
I think it's like anything in medicine where mm-hmm. there's a huge range in terms of the specific biology and the specific symptoms. We have that with all sorts of garden variety medical conditions, mm-hmm. whether it be thyroid disease or heart disease or whatever. We don't treat everybody the same way. We customize to their circumstance based on the rest of their biology and how this is affecting them and such. And so, again, back to my idea that even if this is very simple, even if this ended up being just one gene, it's still going to require customization to the individual in a very dramatic way.
Dr. Joshua Safer, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You are very welcome.
Dr. Joshua Safer is the director of the Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery at the Boston University Medical Center. He's also a member of the Endocrine Society Task Force on Transgender Clinical Practice Guidelines. More coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about the science and medicine of the transgender condition. Transgender people often struggle to find healthcare professionals to work with for everyday issues. The process of transitioning involves its own set of health risks. Joining us now in the studio is a physician who works at the Wexner Medical Center's Transgender Primary Care Clinic, Dr. Melissa Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I read that transgender persons are at an increased risk for certain types of chronic diseases, cancers, and mental health problems. Why certain diseases and cancers?
So as a marginalized group, transgender individuals face a lot of barriers, including, you know, there's actually an economic and educational achievement gap, and some of that may be due to the bullying and discrimination that they face at younger ages. So as a marginalized group, they have higher rates of cigarette smoking and sometimes other unhealthy behaviors. And so that's one of the things that we address at our primary care clinic.
Why is there a need for a transgender primary care clinic? It's because of it's just a more accepting place, or is there more to it than that?
So that's definitely part of the reason. So our clinic was started in late 2014 by Dr. Maria Barnett and Dr. Andrew Keister. And Maria Barnett's a family physician. Andrew Keister is an internal medicine physician. And it was started in response to a need that they saw in the community. For gender-affirming and compassionate care for these patients. There's really not any accurate estimate of how many transgender individuals are in Central Ohio, but we think the number is somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 individuals.
That's a big mark.
Yeah,
that's
a it lot. Is. Yeah, there's a lot that we don't know. And those numbers are just kind of based on the Williams Institute data. There is also some data that came out right around the time when the Transgender Primary Care Clinic was established from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey, which showed that 28% of transgender individuals experienced harassment in medical settings because of their transgender status, and that up to 19% were refused care due to transgender status. So obviously this is a huge problem. It's keeping people out of the medical system, and it's keeping people from getting the primary care screenings that they would need and control of their chronic conditions and a lot more than just gender-affirming therapies.
Jack in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to know, I had a question a few days ago. I was watching programs where little children are already transgendered. They're a boy is a girl and a girl is a boy. They've already made the change. They're not even 8, 9 years old yet. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is when they have the operation to make them biologically men or women, how is that done with children?
Yeah. Do you have, first of all, Dr. Davis, do you have children as patients?
So our youngest patient was a high school student, and then we treat patients all the way up into their 60s. We really don't specialize in pediatric patients. I would say one of the most common misconceptions that the public has about care of transgender individuals is that every transgender individual will go through a complete medical and surgical transition, and that's not really the case. So some individuals will undergo a social transition only, meaning that they dress and live as their preferred gender, whereas other people will feel more comfortable if they go through medical and surgical therapies, including hormones, chest surgery, and genital surgery. So what typically happens with children is that they will see a pediatric endocrinologist, you know, which is not my specialty, and they will, some children will end up going on hormone blockers, which will kind of delay the decision until they're a little bit older. But as far as I know, genital surgery isn't done on a routine basis to minor patients.
Okay. Jack, thanks a lot for that call. When a transgender individual decides to transition and starts taking hormones, hormones might be the alpha and the omega on it. That might be all they do.
Yes, exactly.
And what are you – so – is that something that you monitor at the primary care level?
Yes, absolutely. So when a patient decides that they're ready to take steps towards transition that includes hormones, we sit down with them and we go through a very detailed informed consent process, meaning informed consent, we do not require any type of letter or any type of approval from a mental health professional. It's based on the patient's own understanding of the risks and the benefits, and then our understanding if it is a medically acceptable risk for that patient. And so we do monitor certain blood levels at baseline and then usually around 3 and 6 months to make sure that they're not having unacceptable side effects from the hormones and that they're kind of reaching their goal level if there's any question about that.
What are the side effects of taking hormones like that? What are the risks in general?
So with feminizing hormone therapy, which would mean our patients are taking estrogen, so one of the biggest risks would be an increase in a blood clot. So we kind of assess the patient's baseline risk. For example, if they're cigarette smokers, then we ask them to stop because it's really an unacceptable combination, cigarette smoke and exogenous estrogen. We also would kind of take into account any genetic factors that they might have. If they have a family history of pulmonary embolism or deep vein thrombosis, then we may switch to a different modality of estrogen. For example, there's oral estrogen, which can sometimes be used sublingually, meaning the patient will let the tablet dissolve. And then there's also transdermal estrogen, which is used via a patch that's applied to the skin. And transdermal estrogen has a little bit of a lower risk of liver damage and of blood clots than the oral estrogen. So the therapy is really individualized to the patient. There's really no one-size-fits-all approach for hormone therapy.
For people who can't get hormone therapy or don't get it, there are other things that they do to amend their outward appearance, right?
Yes. So, for example, if we have a transgender male patient, some of them are more comfortable, kind of minimizing the appearance of their breasts. And so they'll use like a binder or an external garment that kind of takes care of that, where they don't have to undergo surgery to have a more male appearance. So for some patients, a social transition is really all that they need in order to feel happier and to kind of relieve that dysphoria, even
find
though we don't
group.
Like using that word.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, to kind of just feel more comfortable in their own skin. And so if they live and act as the gender that they're comfortable with, then that's really all they need.
Does the transgender primary care clinic at the Wexner Medical Center, does it help people address those issues? Or does it refer?
I would say, so for hormone therapy, we do offer that. We also link patients to any specialists that they would need for their chronic conditions and link them to mental health resources if they need a little bit of support with their transition. We refer to surgeons if they are looking for surgical therapy, but the approach is really individualized to the patient.
Transgender persons can have higher rates of depression and anxiety compared to others, and that probably goes back in part to that marginalization.
It does, yes. It can be a little bit difficult to pick apart the reason for the depression and the anxiety. A lot of it is due to the gender dysphoria that they've experienced and due to discrimination and sometimes mistreatment at the hands of family members, mental health care providers, and health professionals, whereas maybe other mental health problems that they face would be due to their genetic predisposition or other reasons. But we consider the role of the mental health provider as more of a person of support to kind of facilitate their transition and help them work through issues rather than a gatekeeper to hormone therapy or other gender-affirming therapies.
Is there a goal at all at the Transgender Primary Care Clinic to help people who are patients there eventually feel comfortable going out and seeking their health care in the general population?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of our most important missions at the Transgender Primary Care Clinic is our educational mission. And so in the clinic, we incorporate all levels of learners, from medical students to our staff to residents. And we have kind of reached out beyond the clinic. For example, Dr. Maria Barnett has given grand rounds, lectures in several different departments and trained staff there in order to improve the experience of transgender individuals in the healthcare system.
How did you get into it? How did you find your way to this?
So I became involved actually with one patient. It was a patient who was scheduled with me on accident. They were supposed to be with Dr. Maria Barnett, and I had just underwent some continuing medical education on transgender issues, so I was kind of all ready to help. And the patient arrived, and my staff said, "Oh, Dr. Davis, this patient's here to see you, and they've been waiting for over 6 months, and they thought the appointment was with Dr. Barnett, and they're crying now because they've been waiting this long to get their hormone therapy." And so I said, "Wait, I'll see him." And so I went, and I met the patient and talked to them, and it was just very kind of humbling to sit down and listen to their story. Most of our patients have known about their gender identity since they were maybe just learning how to talk and just learning the differences between boys and girls. So many of them have waited for some type of affirmation or waited for some type of medical treatment for many, many years. And so it really was an honor to be able to treat this patient. And I let them know that I was just kind of getting into this type of medicine and consulted closely with Dr. Barnett. And then from there, just kind of grew.
Mm-hmm. And you said you had taken some continuing education on this score. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking with Dr. Joshua Safer from the Boston University Medical Center about the programs that they've initiated there. What is the education like when it comes to this issue for doctors?
So I think the most important thing is just kind of understanding the whole concept of gender identity, and then also how to create a welcoming and accepting environment for the patient. So at our first appointment, we always start each visit by asking the patient, you know, you introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Dr. Davis. And then you ask the patient, what would you like to be called? And what pronouns would you like used? And that's very important. It's something that seems like a minor thing, but if you make an effort to use the correct pronoun, then that inspires a lot of trust in the patient. And then also I had to learn a little bit about the hormone therapy, the options that were available, the dosages, the monitoring. And really, that's not extremely complex compared to some of the other conditions that we treat as primary care doctors. For example, diabetes, hypertension, heart failure, things like that.
And then there, for lack of a better word, I'll say dysphoria. That is a particular thing for somebody who may. There are people out there who say they identify as one thing, but there is a problem. It's not. I mean, there. It's, you know, just like anything. There's going to be a small number of people that maybe are mentally ill.
Yeah. So. We have had, you know, the rare case where we feel like the risks of the hormone therapy outweigh the benefits. You know, we have individuals that are maybe not, or that are lacking the capacity to decide that for themselves and undergo the informed consent process. So that's kind of something that happens when we sit down with the patient and go over the informed consent model that we use.
And that's something you figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Melissa Davis, thanks so much for joining us today. This is a conversation I'm sure we'll continue to have over time, but I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you so much.
Dr. Melissa Davis, a physician at the OSU Wexner Medical Center Transgender Primary Care Clinic. Thanks for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.